We sound a call to freedom that will heal a broken land. As the call rings out more clearly, violent forces will disband. Prison doors will open, bonds will loosen by the Spirit's hand. The truth will set us free. Free at last, oh hallelujah. Free at last, oh hallelujah. Now, Sophia, you have freed us. Your truth has set us free.
Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show is by progressive Christian Jan Aldridge Clanton, and it's called We Sound a Call to Freedom. If you listen closely to the words, it refers to wisdom or Sophia helping us break the shackles of our contemporary world. Yes, wisdom in the feminine as opposed to patriarchy's clenched fists. You can find the entire song with lovely images on YouTube, and if we have time before the end of the show, I'll play all the different verses. And thanks, Jan, for having me, allowing me to share it here on the show. And what a busy night I have in store for you. At the top of the hour, we have a controversial topic. You might even wonder if it's in keeping with our theme here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine. It's why the buildings fell on 9/11. Well, David Chandler, a retired physics and math teacher for 3 decades, got curious about how the buildings could have fallen after seeing videos. He drew on his knowledge and experience to analyze what he saw happening, and he's going to share that with us. And why isn't this off topic for us? Well, once one considers how history has been written by the conquerors, how patriarchy uses sexism, racism, worker and environmental exploitation to get what it wants, how herstory has been subverted, how an administration can lie a country into a bogus war, well, then your mind opens up to many possibilities, and one has to have the courage to ask hard questions of the status quo and use some critical thinking, even if it could potentially lead to some disturbing possibilities. Then we have a special brief guest on with us tonight, a sort of last-minute addition to tonight's show. Angie Buchanan from the Parliament of World Religions is going to tell us about something going on there with the Council and make an important plea as she updates us on the status of that important group. And we're hoping that listeners might help spread the word and maybe even help. Then as we cross the threshold into the latter part of the show, Dominic James, author of the Reiki Man trilogy, will talk about the power of using Reiki. We'll look at what it is, why some people in the church are so afraid of it and warn their congregants against using it. James is calling in from the UK tonight, and he's going to chat about what Reiki can lead to and how it might help your life. But first, a bit of housekeeping and sharing before we get to our first awesome guest. First, a shout-out to Evelina from Australia, who sent me this lovely email this week, and I want to share it with you. Evelina said, "Dear Karen, after listening to your wonderfully insightful podcast for the last 2 years, I wanted to send an email to tell you how much your work has made a difference in my life. I am a woman in my late 20s living in Australia and had initially been brought up as Catholic. All my knowledge of the divine feminine has come from books and my own soul searching until I stumbled on your podcast, which truly changed me. You've given those of us that do not have goddess leaders or role models in our local community a means of learning and being guided along this path that can feel so lonely at times. The guests on your show are so diverse and interesting that they have truly opened my mind to new ideas and possibilities that if I had been left to my own devices, it would have taken me years, if ever, to stumble upon such information. So from the bottom of my heart, I simply want to say thank you. Thank you for all the work you've put into your podcast, and I hope you continue your wonderful work." Well, thank you, thank you, thank you so much, Evelina. I really appreciate that. You know, that's awesome that you would send that to me. It does make a world of difference. Also, thanks to the listeners who brought this to my attention. Seems I was named on the blog Theopoetics Goddess Musings as one of the top 13 most influential people in goddess spirituality. I was right there with some of my mentors, Rhianne Eisler, Merlin Stone, Maria Gimbutas, Charlene Spretnak. Here's what they said about me. Through her weekly radio show, Voices of the Sacred Feminine, I would venture to say that Tate is one of the most influential and dedicated goddess advocates of the present day. Wow. That is truly gas in my tank. So thanks again, Goddess Musings. And for listeners, you can find her great blog at goddesspriestess.com. And while I'm thinking about blogs, more thanks goes out to my wonderful new assistant, Cindy Williams, for helping me put together my brand new blog called Herstory with Karen Tate on Blogger. I hope you'll go there and subscribe. I have the first few posts up now. The first one was Defining Herstory for Women's History Month, and the most recent one that just went up in the last few days is 20 Sins and Inhumanities Against Women Today. Which is the perfect segue into asking if you saw on social media the link to the article from Women's Press out of San Luis Obispo County in California by former President Jimmy Carter called Losing My Religion for Equality. I believe he may have originally posted it in January. Former President Carter says, women and girls have been discriminated against for too long and a twisted interpretation of the Word of God. I hope you'll go to the article and share it around very widely. I'm going to read just a few excerpts of the article for you because it's really great, and this is exactly what we're talking about, and he is exactly the kind of man who will help women break the shackles of misogyny and oppression. He says, this is former President Carter. I've been a practicing Christian all my life and a deacon and Bible teacher for many years. My faith is a source of strength and comfort to me, as religious beliefs are to hundreds of millions of people around the world. So my decision to sever my ties with the Southern Baptist Convention after six decades was painful and difficult. It was, however, an unavoidable decision when the convention's leaders, quoting a few carefully selected Bible verses and claiming that Eve was created second to Adam and was responsible for original sin, ordained that women must be subservient to their husbands and prohibited from serving as deacons, pastors, or chaplains in the military service. This view that women are somehow inferior to men is not restricted to one religion or belief. Women are prevented from playing a full and equal role in many faiths, nor, tragically, does its influence stop at the walls of the church, mosque, synagogue, or temple. This discrimination, unjustifiably attributed to a higher authority, has provided a reason or excuse for the deprivation of women's equal rights across the world for centuries. At its most repugnant, the belief that women must be subjugated to the wishes of men excuses slavery, violence, forced prostitution, genital mutilation, and national laws that omit rape as a crime. But it also costs many millions of girls and women control over their own bodies and lives and continues to deny them fair access to education, health, employment, and influence within their own communities. The article goes on. It is well worth reading. Please, please, please look for it. Again, it's called Women's Press. It's Voices, Views, and Visions of the Women of San Luis Obispo County, that's in California. Or you might even just put in the title of the article, Losing My Religion for Equality by Jimmy Carter. So, again, please share it widely. I'm always complaining about where are the progressive religious leaders, why don't they find their voice to speak out against institutionalized discrimination and oppression? Well, here are some. And finally, did you know International Mother Earth Day is coming up on April 22nd? This is not to be confused with Earth Day celebrations. This is a bit different and separate, but equally important. I discovered this while looking at the United Nations website last night. It said Mother Earth is a common expression for the planet Earth in a number of countries and regions, which reflects the interdependence that exists among human beings, other living species, and the planet. For instance, Bolivians call Mother Earth Pachamama, and Nicaraguans refer to her as Tononzin. The proclamation of April 22nd as International Mother Earth Day is an acknowledgement that the Earth and its ecosystems provide its inhabitants with life and sustenance. It also recognizes a collective responsibility as called for in the 1992 Rio Declaration to promote harmony with nature and the Earth to achieve a just balance among the economic, social, and environmental needs of present and future generations of humanity. This year in June, world leaders will gather at the Rio Plus 20 Sustainable Development Conference to discuss on two main themes: how to build a green economy to achieve sustainable development and lift people out of poverty, and how to improve international coordination for sustainable development. So I wanted to just go ahead and share that with you. Now, the chat room is open. I'm launching it right now. I know some of you emailed me and said that you wanted to potentially chat. So I'm going to start the show by saying welcome to David Chandler. Hi, David.
Hello.
Thank you. Thank you so much. While I got my housekeeping out of the way, let me start, David, by telling listeners a little bit more about you, and then we'll jump into our topic, why the buildings came down on 9/11. So listeners, David is a retired physics teacher. He taught physics and math at high school and college for 30 years. When he looked at the videos of the buildings coming down on 9/11, he got curious about how it could happen, and he drew on his knowledge and experience to analyze what he saw happening. When he posted several short videos explaining his analysis on YouTube, it caught the attention of the leaders of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and he was invited to join their research team. He is currently on the board of Scientists for 9/11 and the International Center for 9/11 Studies. So, David, let me start off by asking you, I would imagine from feedback I got today that there are a lot of people that find it hard to hear what we're maybe going to talk about tonight. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the main issue, really, is that, I mean, if you look at the evidence for what I'm going to be talking about, it's really, really blatant that these things could not have happened as advertised. And yeah, even physicists and engineers and people who really ought to know better, they look at it and they will not go there. There's so many people who will not even consider the possibility that the government could have been involved in something like this.
Well, just for some context, because, I don't know, I think coming from where I come from, you know, being a woman who grew up in the Bible Belt her entire life, living in that bubble, then moving to California and finding a whole history, a whole spirituality that had been kept from me, well, you start to scratch your head and you go, well, you know what, if I could have been duped about that, I could have been duped about other things. So I'm just going to, like I said, for context, mention a few other things that, you know, if people knew their history or if they want to go and Google it, I think, you know, these are shameful things that are in our past that actually happened that it would be maybe hard to imagine happen. The first is, I mean, there's some of these things are controversial, some aren't, but it's pretty widely known, I think, and even accepted that England and President Roosevelt, they had advanced knowledge of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, but it was important that the United States get into the war, so they let it happen. The English city Coventry was sacrificed in World War II. They let the Germans bomb it because they didn't want the Germans to know they had broke some code. Because if they saved Coventry, the Germans would have been tipped off, and that might have affected the outcome of the war. But if you lived in Coventry, you were sacrificed. Right here in the United States, the story of the Tuskegee Airmen who became a syphilis experiment. And we know, you know, anybody who's been paying attention, maybe you recently watched the MSNBC documentary with Rachel Maddow that talked about the selling of the Iraq War. Well, you know, we know that we were lied into that war. We know that, you know, the Bush administration outed a CIA agent, you know, Valerie Plame and her husband, who were trying to say, look, there were no weapons of mass destruction. Michael Moore tried to highlight a lot of the stuff about 9/11 in his documentary, Fahrenheit 9/11. But, you know, people tried to demonize him, even though he has been a voice for the people, talking out against guns, talking out against, you know, corporate oppression of American workers. So, you know, these things are hard to hear, but I really think we have to hear them. And I want to thank you for being on the show to talk about this tough subject.
Okay. Well,
where's the best place to start?
Well, I was just going to say, I agree that it takes a bit of something has to happen in your head that gets you to the place where you can allow yourself to think thoughts that aren't sort of conventional. And for me, it came through the 1980s when I was involved with refugees from Central America during the whole Contra War and that kind of thing, through a church I was involved with down in Southern California. And that sort of introduced me big time to the fact that the United States behavior outside its borders is not what the people of the United States would approve of, or we don't believe that it should behave that way, or that it does behave that way if we're just focused on what's happening here at home. So when I saw the first signs on 9/11, I saw when the planes hit the buildings and so forth like that, my immediate reaction was the chickens have come home to roost. People, I mean, I was thinking at that time that if this was a terrorist incident, that people are getting back at us, not because they're just evil and we're pure, but that we have done so many things to so many people all around the globe, destabilizing governments and undercutting freedoms. I mean, we've helped to throw out democratically elected leaders in favor of dictatorships in a number of countries.
Right.
And this type of behavior comes at a price. And I was thinking initially that that's what it was. But I just want to let me restart it this way, is that my involvement in the 9/11 truth movement did not start with really thinking, oh, this is something the government did, and then trying to work from that point. That was at the end of the process that it points there. What I started with personally is looking at, and it's sort of like objectifying things a bit, but you just look at the buildings as they're collapsing, and it was completely unexpected. And you look at it happen, and you say, how could that happen? And then little things caught my attention, like I saw one projectile coming out from the North Tower. It seemed to be launched basically horizontally, and it went all the way across the street, and it seemed like it either went behind a building or crashed into the building or something. And this was clearly a large piece of structure that was being thrown. And I used the knowledge I have. I literally went to the television screen and froze. I was on a videotape at this point. I froze it and stepped through it. I was able to estimate the speed of this projectile, and that was really the first little piece of analysis for myself that I did. And just from that kind of simple, rather crude measurement, I could estimate that the speed was in the neighborhood of 60 miles an hour. So here is a chunk of stuff being thrown out of the building horizontally at about 60 miles an hour. It's a tremendous kick to get these wall panels that are that make up the surface of the building, about 4 tons. And so to get something that's about in that neighborhood of several tons moving horizontally at 60 miles an hour takes a tremendous amount of energy. And so right off the bat, I was intrigued, and I started reading, started digging into it. Following that, I gave a number of talks locally, some to like the Unitarian Church and a couple other local groups, And, you know, when I was giving talks at this level, I pretty much just displayed all the stuff that I have found in my research on the internet and some of my own insights and so forth. But then I gave a talk. I asked if I could give a talk at a physics teachers conference. They said yes. So in preparing for that, I decided I'd really had better do some better measurements myself. And so I used a tool that I have that accessible in the classroom, which was at the time it was a simple tool called Physics Toolkit. And you could take a video and break it apart frame by frame and use it to analyze motion. And this is like one of the things you do in a physics class is analyze the motion, like of projectiles and collisions between things and so forth. And by using this tool, I was able to get some better measurements. And I measured pretty much everything I could find that's measurable. One of the things that I measured that turned out to be most significant was the speed with which the buildings came down. Now, are you familiar with the fact that there was a third building?
Well, are you talking about Building 7?
Yes. Now, many of your listeners may not be aware of that because that was not widely covered in the mainstream press.
Well, I didn't know about Building 7 until I went to a peace rally, and there was a group there talking about Building 7. But just to go back just a little bit, I think one of the things that really made me suspicious about this whole thing, now granted, I am not a trained physicist, but and you might think this is funny, but it is what it is. I've always been intrigued watching them demolish the building, the hotels in Las Vegas, how those buildings look coming down. And you can tell that they sort of implode from, you know, from the inside and come down. I don't know, I'm probably not using the right words, but these buildings looked so much like the buildings coming down in Las Vegas in a planned demolition. That's the thing that got me suspicious, and that's why I started listening to people and physicists and, you know, experts like yourself who had the science to back up what my intuition told me looked a little bit suspicious. But please go ahead and tell people about Building 7 that okay. You know, no one even seems to even know about, the third building.
Well, it's been talked about a lot, and the primary place you'd find out about it is on the internet because the mainstream media has literally not featured Building 7. It's a third building in the complex. There's actually seven buildings in the World Trade Center complex. There's the Twin Towers. The next highest building was Building 7, and it's across the street from the North Tower. And it was not hit by a plane, and it didn't come down until the evening. And it seemed like everybody and their brother in New York knew it was going to come down. There's lots of reporters who talked about that's the building that's going to come down next and things like that. And so it was like very strange circumstances. And yet, if you look at the building come down, that's the one that absolutely looks like demolished buildings, okay? The Twin Towers, there's sort of a different pattern, really. I mean, on the surface, it's sort of like another demolition, but it's very atypical in the sense the towers were exploded from the top and it sort of zippered its way down the building. That's not the way demolitions are typically done. They normally start low in the building and they knock the support out and allow the falling building to participate in crushing what's left.
Okay.
And so forth. So that's a big difference. But you know, on the surface, yes, all three of them look very artificial. The Building 7 collision, the Building 7 demolition, if you watch it on a video, it literally looks like it just sinks into the ground. I mean, it's like the whole building that you can see it starts moving down. And so clearly the demolition is occurring low in the building, just like in a classic demolition. It's a tall building, and so what you're actually seeing in the videos is only the top half of the building, or maybe even a little less.
Now, what was Building 7, David? Why would that one have to be destroyed?
Well, it was it had a lot of high security things in it. I have a list of some of my things I've done. I can't exactly parrot it from memory, but it's like they had offices of the CIA, they had the Secret Service, so a lot of security agency types of things like that. It had the New York Office of Emergency Management. It had a number of banks and so forth. In any case, it was a high security building. You would not expect you'd be able to get in and out of it easily to carry explosives or anything else into it unless you had high security clearance. So the fact that it came down like a demolition is very critical here. The thing that my measurement ended up, I'll tell you that story because that's sort of one of the key pieces of
information.
Are we
back to that projectile at 60 miles an hour?
No. Okay. I'm talking about the building, the speed it came down.
Okay.
If you take the roof line of Building 7 and track it, like I did in my software, if you track the motion, you find that it doesn't come down just fast. It comes down absolutely as fast as though you simply took a rock and let go. It fell at absolute free fall for about 2.5 seconds. So in other words, the roof line of the building is coming straight down. The entire building is crushing straight down through itself at free fall.
So it went too fast is what you're saying.
It came down
too fast.
It went at the speed that you would expect. It's actually called an acceleration. It's how fast the speed builds up. It's what we're really looking at. But in any case, the acceleration downward is what you would expect if there is zero resistance, absolute zero resistance. And so it's impossible that the building could come down and the motion of the building crush what's underneath it. It can't do anything. All of its energy is used to speed it up. And so if something is in free fall, it can't do any work on anything else, or it's using some of its energy for other purposes, and therefore it can't build up as much speed. For it to build up the amount of speed that it did, all of its energy went into simply falling and picking up speed. It was not crushing what was underneath. Therefore, what was underneath, which was a tremendous amount of support, these columns are designed for anywhere 3 to 5 times the weight that it actually experiences, the safety margins and all that. For those columns to have given way and allowed the building to come down at free fall means they absolutely had to have been eliminated by some other mechanism. And the fact is, this building, by the way, it's 100 meters. That's just a little over the size of a football field, side to side, 100 meters wide. And in fact, if you were to put the floor plan of the Building 7 on a football field, it would pretty much occupy the entire football field. That's how big this building is. And yet the roof line, if you see it from a distance, it stayed flat and it came down uniformly. So in other words, the roof line stayed flat as it fell. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, all of the columns across the entire cross-section of that building had to have failed simultaneously and in such a thorough manner that they offered no resistance. It wasn't just that they offered less resistance, they offered zero resistance.
So they
had to have been removed.
So that says to you they were probably...
to me they were absolutely taken out with explosives. There's no other way to accomplish that.
Okay.
So look where that leads.
Let me just go back to make sure I haven't missed a piece of the puzzle.
Okay.
And maybe this was just what sort of tweaked you to look into this, and maybe it isn't real significant, but I want to make sure I'm not missing any of it. That projectile that you said first caught your attention that was going horizontally at 60 miles an hour, does that have anything to do with this whole story, or that just was the trigger that made you look at this more closely?
Well, in the first place, it was the trigger that got me into it. That was the reason I mentioned that. It was I started looking at it, and I started realizing that you can actually look at the videos and get information there that you can make sense out of, and you can come to some conclusions about. So what would launch something horizontally at 60 miles an hour is a huge, that should raise huge question marks in anybody's mind who is competent to understand the science here, and probably the general public as well. But see, there are many, many separate grounds for concluding that this was done with explosives.
Okay.
So the first one, the main one that I was initially involved in that actually led somewhere conclusively is this measurement of free fall. I want to contrast this. The investigation, the official investigation of 9/11 was put off for a long time. The administration resisted having any investigation. They had a very, very cursory in and out type of a thing where the investigators were given a guided walkthrough of Ground Zero and so forth, and then they came up with the FEMA report was generated from that, and basically there was no analysis done, and it was with partial information. They didn't have access even to the blueprints, so it was just a very cursory initial report. But after that, years went by, and finally what they did was they handed the investigation over to NIST. NIST is the National Institute for Standards and Technology. All right, it used to be called the National Bureau of Standards. So it's a scientific agency of the government. It's not an independent group. It's an agency of the Commerce Department. All right? And the NIST investigation did a big analysis of supposedly why the buildings fell. It didn't even mention Building 7. And so then afterwards, then they said, oh, well, we set that aside because that's going to take some more. They left that to the very bitter end of the Bush administration, and they put out in August of 2008, they gave their preliminary or their semi-final, I guess I should say, release of the document, and then they gave out their final document in November, right after the elections. So it was postponed to the bitter end of the administration, and then they came out with the conclusion that Building 7 collapsed strictly due to fire, that fire by itself somehow was able to do this. And they basically claimed that thermal expansion of a beam pushed another beam off of its seat and so forth. And basically they came up with a scenario which they claimed caused a single column to fail. And then when the stress redistributed itself, the other columns then started to fail, and then the whole thing came down. It's a completely ludicrous proposition.
I'm curious if physics teachers or people who know about physics across the country have been talking about this amongst themselves.
Well, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth has a couple of thousand scientists and engineers who are convinced that it needs a new investigation. And so that's one place. Scientists for 9/11 Truth is another whole group of scientists who are involved in this. And there are a lot of scientists and engineers and architects and so forth who have seen this and are convinced that the official story is bogus. There are a lot of others who, like I said at the outset, simply will not go there. And
well, they're afraid to ruin their careers or something. You know, maybe they believe it, but they just they have too much to lose.
Well, part of it is they might believe it, but be afraid of it. And the other is that there's psychological barriers they put up to where. And one of the things is you'll hear in the press all the time is you hear about the word truthers. You know, that's a word that has a derogatory connotations. It's like,
right. You
know, somebody that's using irrational reasoning or something like that.
Well,
and
that's a typical ploy to, you know, to demean people who speak out against the status quo. I mean, this is much more trivial, obviously, but I think, as a feminist, I think of the feminazi label, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We just want equality, but there's something wrong with us, you know, so we're the crazy ones.
Right. Well, it's amazing. I mean, when I approached a couple of my professors from the college I went to, I majored in physics at Harvey Mudd College. And one of my professors was very intrigued and was pretty much on board. And he watched the things the videos that I produced and so forth. And he, you know, he agreed. Another one, simply, he literally would not go there. He just wouldn't talk about it. In fact, he was over at Cal Poly, and I was saying Richard Gage, who's the head of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, was going to be speaking there. So I wrote to him, emailed him, and said he was going to be there. I'd like to meet with him, and would he like to see this? And he just didn't even respond. I mean, it's like there are people who just see it as, well, the other thing is, the other term as well as truthers is calling it a conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm.
As though, for instance, conspiracies don't happen.
Right.
And the other, the term conspiracy theory, I think, really originates with the Kennedy assassination. When was it something that was done by one of the agencies, or was it done by a lone gunman?
Right.
And so that was where that term came into use. Whereas in this case, every theory is a conspiracy theory if you take it literally, because even the official story is that it was a conspiracy of a bunch of Arab terrorists that did this.
Well, and I also saw a documentary that showed that some of these supposed Arab terrorists, a few of them are actually still alive. So,
right.
So some of those guys, couldn't have been, the ones that actually did it. But, well, maybe where we have probably about 20 minutes left. I just want to sort of give you, a barometer of where we're at, so we can fit as much in as possible. You say that the jet fuel and fires could not have caused the collapse of the Twin Towers.
Right.
So speak about that a little bit.
Okay. Well, there's a problem of temperature. If you take jet fuel, which is essentially kerosene, okay, and you normally burn kerosene in a lamp, you burn it in a stove, and you can, it feels hot, but it's not going to melt the stove, is it? I mean, the temperature the kerosene can get up to, in fact, hydrocarbons in general, whether it's kerosene, gasoline, everything like that, it can get up as high as about 1,600 degrees Fahrenheit in atmospheric conditions, okay? There's good reason to believe that the fires in the World Trade Center were a lot cooler than that, because all the black smoke, and when there's a lot of black smoke, it means there's partial combustion. It's really not efficient combustion going on. You know, if you have a stove and it's all you have a sooty flame, it's because the fuel's really not reacting. But if you get a clean blue flame and all that on your stove, you know that's efficient burning going on. Anyway, even at the most optimistic, perfect burning condition, the temperature that you can achieve is it misses the melting point of iron by over 1,000 degrees. Okay? Now, there's some little beeps on the phone, and I'm not sure how to interpret those. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I hear you.
Okay. All right. So, in other words, if you burn kerosene, if you burn office furnishings, anything that was available to burn in a fire like that, the firemen went into the building. They weren't concerned because they knew that steel frame buildings don't collapse with fire. And the reason they don't collapse is the fires can't get anywhere near hot enough to cause the steel structure to fail like that. And so they had to come up with very elaborate hypothetical scenarios to account for why they might have failed that way. There's another side of this, though. So on the one hand, the official story says that what was causing these fires was the jet fuel, the kerosene, and the office furnishings, and that's what did it. And yet there is evidence in the physical evidence that steel really did melt, that there really was molten steel in the basement, in the rubble pile. And in addition, there are iron spheres that are littered throughout the dust that covered New York City. And so you had melting of iron and steel going on which indicates temperatures over 1,000 degrees hotter than the jet fuel and office furnishings could possibly have produced.
So we're back
therefore,
to explosives.
Therefore, something else had to be in there that was chemically reacting to produce those high temperatures.
Okay. All right, let's sort of jump away from the science of why the official story just defies science. And let's get more in because people can go to the website 9/11 Speak Out and probably read more about this. I would imagine see videos and stuff.
Oh, yeah. That's on that site, by the way, is 911speakout.org.
Okay.
And that's the work from myself and John Cole, who's an engineer in Florida, and the two of us collaborate on that website. And from there, I have links to a lot of the other good websites on the subject.
Okay. So let's get more into the why. How do we know government agencies were involved?
Well, okay, let's look at Building 7 for a minute, which is the clearest it's probably the clearest smoking gun of any we have, other than the fact that there was these iron pellets, and in addition, there's also, I didn't mention, but there's remnants of the material itself called nanothermite that's found in the dust samples. Okay, so there's a lot of this evidence that indicates there was an explosive. We think that the active ingredient was called nanothermite, and what does that say? Well, first of all, nanothermite is a military-grade research new kind of a material. It's not something you can buy over the counter. It would be accessible to the military and hardly anybody else. Okay, so that's one right there. Another is that in order to rig a building for demolition, it takes months. It takes lots of preparation. It's not that somebody placed a bomb at the bottom of the World Trade Center. They laced it from high in the building all the way down. If you watch the explosions, you can see these puffs of stuff coming out of the windows all the way down, sometimes 20 to 40 floors below where the actual collapse front is. So there's stuff going on throughout the building. The estimate is that there was anywhere from tens to hundreds of tons of this explosive material that was imported into the building. One of my colleagues in this research is a Danish guy, Niels Herrit, and he gets asked a lot of times, how did they get it in there? And his standard reply has become on pallets. You know, they had to have taken a huge quantity of this, and if they have access to the elevator shafts, they have access to all of the columns in the center of the building. And so one another fact that's worth mentioning is they had a 9-month-long elevator repair program going on in the World Trade Center during that time. So there are workmen who have access to the elevators going up and down these things, doing whatever workmen do, carrying pallets of stuff, and everybody just ignores it because that's what workmen do.
Right.
But that's the kind of thing, you know, I don't want to get into saying this is exactly precisely what they did, but it's the kind of thing that makes a plausible scenario of how they could have pulled it off.
So, David, let me cut to the chase here. Are you familiar with the book by Naomi Klein, The Shock Doctrine, Rise of Disaster Capitalism,
right.
Where, and for listeners who don't know, she basically posits that political machinations are required to force unsavory economic policies or new laws on resisting countries, or maybe their ideas that citizens would resist. When we cut to the chase, is that if you had to speculate? I mean, unless you think you know for certain, is that what was going on here? Was this about leading us into a war so that the military-industrial complex could make a lot of money? Or was this about, all of our civil liberties that have been taken away since then? What was the purpose behind all of this?
Well, I'm leaving my role as a science guy here and getting into my general knowledge on in terms of the whole social political scene here. But it's pretty clear, like you spelled out, that they had the Bush people had a very definite agenda that they wanted to revolutionize the way we interacted with the rest of the world. And this war on terrorism is sort of redefining this nebulous boogeyman out there that we can go after as much as we want, and it'll never, you know, how do you have the final shot in the war against terror? Because anybody could pop up and be a terrorist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have ambitions that involve military spending and, you know, in direct intervention into situations all over the world for whatever reasons, having a war on terror is like a perfect, it's like a passport that gets you into any war you want to, you know, not a get out of jail free card, it's a get into war card, you know.
Right.
It gives you a open access to get to do what you want to do in the world under this very flimsy kind of a rationale. I am appalled at how the whole Islamic, you know, the Arabs and Islamic cultures around the world are being vilified in the modern situation. They had nothing to do with this. I should back off a little bit. If there was any role played by Arabs in this at all, it was strictly as either patsies or collaborators with a cover story, you know.
So you don't think Osama bin Laden was involved?
Well, if he was, it was simply as
the front man, the face
going
for
along.
It?
Yeah, put a face on it.
Right, right.
There's good reason to believe he didn't even survive to the end of 2001, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole idea that he is this arch-evil kind of a boogeyman out there, I mean, he worked for the CIA. I mean,
yeah, during when Afghanistan was fighting with Russia, right?
And beyond, and right up to 9/11, and possibly right through 9/11.
Well,
I mean,
yeah, Michael Moore brings up the really interesting ties between his family and the Bushes, too.
Right, right.
David, I have one of my guests once in the chat room wants to ask you a question. Are you okay with me?
Sure.
Okay, hang on. Hi, caller. You have a question for David?
Well, yeah, I was gonna commend David for what he's doing. But David, you know, it's kind of difficult to get the public involved in this because the subject matter goes way over the head of the average citizen. But I spent nearly four decades erecting buildings like that, and what you're saying is absolutely true. But the layperson should be brought into the equation. Scientists and engineers have the threat of reputation and jobs held over their heads, and you never would get a true answer from them. So maybe we can talk again, but I really commend you for even still at this late in time to continue to bring this up, because surely what the public has been told and made to believe is not the truth.
Thank you, caller. So, David, is there any progress being made through the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth? I mean, is this a dead issue now? I mean, have they gotten away with it?
Well, the way I put it is the wars of 9/11 are still there, and it's a live issue as far as I'm concerned. The persecution of Arabs and Muslims is still there. So all of these things, as far as I'm concerned, these haven't gone away. Now, they may succeed in derailing this as far as making it so that, you know, look how long the whole Kennedy assassination thing got run in circles and so forth. So, yeah, we may or may not succeed, but that doesn't justify me giving up on the subject. So
right.
I'm not giving up on it, and there's a lot of people out there who are not giving up on it, and you never know when some kind of a juncture things turn around.
Yeah, somebody will come forward, or a group of people
yeah.
will come forward, because obviously a lot of people had to know about it.
Right.
you know.
And the other thing here is that something I tell people is even more blatant than the government involvement with 9/11 itself is the government's involvement with the cover-up. The whole NIST investigation was such a farce, and the other investigations before it, they have pieces buried away in the investigation that they're little snippets of truth in there, but then they get completely buried. For instance, there's an appendix in one of the early reports where they take this mysterious piece of steel they recovered, and the steel is thinned to like a knife, like a razor edge. So in other words, it's like the steel has been either melted or even evaporated off of this, what was once a girder, till you get a razor sharp piece of metal, and there's holes in it like Swiss cheese. So this is something that can only happen at many thousands of degrees, like 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And this is in the report. It's in an appendix, and yet it just gets brushed aside. That cannot happen if the fuel is kerosene and or office furnishings. And it's in there, and yet it's not there as far as the general conclusions of the report are concerned. So the report is in the business of papering over all of this. The other thing that ties into my research here is the official story on the free fall of Building 7. It started out that NIST claimed Building 7 fell 40% slower than free fall. And this was the status of things in August of 2008. And that was when they came out with their their final draft for public comment is what they called it. And I jumped on that. I made a little video where I put out my measurements. And I got an opportunity to confront them at a technical briefing conference that I did over the internet. And I was able to get a question in, and they go in circles trying to answer it. And I just said, how can something that is so publicly visible and easily measurable be swept aside? Okay, the free fall of Building 7 is absolutely indisputable, and yet they were claiming it fell 40% slower than free fall. That's mind-numbingly stupid on their part, because anybody that has the skills to measure it can see for themselves that they're lying. And they were lying. And why were they lying if they had basically the correct explanation for what was going on?
So do you think it's like the caller said, that so much of the science is over the heads of the people on these committees, or if the committees were a sham?
Well, the committees, I mean, all the official investigations top to bottom were, there may have been some good people on some of them, but they were controlled. And the 9/11 Commission investigation, it's, you know, they had Democrats and Republicans on it, but if you look at some of the participants, look at the histories of the people who were chosen to be on that, and then look at who actually controlled the whole thing. It was a direct operative, and his name escapes me at the moment, but it was a direct operative of the administration, and he was the one. He actually had a draft of the entire report written up before they even began their hearings. And so, this has been documented,
right.
And he very tightly controlled what was going in. That 9/11 Commission report was a consensus report, which means anything for which there was not consensus didn't even go in.
So if you disagree
anything
with
where
everything.
Where there was dissension, it was just left out entirely. So all you have are the elements of things that these non-professional investigators, basically, were able to agree on.
So, David, unfortunately, we're going to have to cut the conversation short because I thought she was on the switchboard. Now she's actually disappeared. Maybe she's going to call back. So, all right. So that buys us a little bit more time. So why do you think we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan? Is it just always about the money?
Well, the analysis I've been reading about it, now this is just in my own reading, and you can get your own view on this, but it wasn't even so much a matter of wanting their oil it's wanting to control the price of their oil. One of the policies that Iraq was doing was they were trying to go their own way and to bring down the price of oil by pumping more out of the ground. And the U.S. oil companies want to keep the price high. And so one of the things they were trying to do in the case of Iraq was shut down their oil production. Same thing with Venezuela, by the way, is that Venezuela, you know, can pump oil onto the world market, and if they release more oil, they bring the price down. And if you basically are focused on keeping the price as high as possible, you want to keep it a rare commodity. So
right.
That was part of it. And the other is just geopolitical strategizing. We're sooner or later coming to the end of oil, and who's going to be positioned where on the globe and in control of what and so forth as the last of the oil resources are depleted.
Right.
And so I'm sure there's maneuvering to make that happen. So basically, it doesn't have to do with somebody did a dastardly deed in New York. It has to do with what can we accomplish and what does it take to get the public to willingly go along with it.
I see.
And my perspective on all this is to speak out as loudly as I can, as often as I can, even on a women's spirituality show. I mean, that's, what a place for me
well,
to show
we're very
up
political
and give this
here.
Kind of a thing. Okay, well, there you go. Well, I found it very interesting to get this invitation, and that was quite intriguing. And I thought, why not?
Well, and I sort of gave the context for that at the beginning, you know, because I think there's so much that we don't know, so much that we have not really heard the truth about, and I think when that happens enough during your lifetime, then you know you stop being a sheeple, and you just don't automatically accept everything that's that's dished out to you. You know,
you want to live in a peaceful world, right?
Well, yeah, we want to live in a peaceful world. We want to
live
in
a fair world. That's right. If you want
to
live where there's peace, where there's justice, where people are respected and so forth, you can't just, be manipulated. You have to help make that a reality, because it's not a reality if those with tremendous power get to play their own game and leave the rest of us aside.
Well, yeah. And I mean, and for me, I also think it's about, sometimes people don't want to hear the truth of what people in goddess spirituality talk about, you know, because it goes against the status quo. You know, it goes against, some of the organized religions. It upsets people's apple carts. But you know what? We need to upset people's apple carts sometimes. People have to hear things that sometimes are hard to hear. So, David, thank you for being on the show, and I just want to give a shout-out to Angie. I see you on the switchboard, and I'm going to be with you in a second. But, David, before you leave us tonight, would you please give your websites again, and if any of my listeners wanted to get in touch with you or find out more about this, where are the most reputable sources so that if they want to be a voice for this, you know, they're talking the facts, they're talking credible stuff and not just things that could get them discredited.
That's a good point, is that there's a lot, I don't know how you're, if you have bleepers or what, there's a lot of crap out there that passes for the 9/11 truth movement. There's reputable stuff, and there is a bunch of stuff that is, as far as we're concerned, a lot of it, I think, is generated with the intent, with the specific intent of discrediting the movement. So it is important that you hear the voices that are credible. If you go to simply my website, 911speakout.org, I have a links page there, and I try to summarize all of the really credible links. And so that's rather than me listing them off. There's Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, for instance. However, watch out for Scholars for 9/11 Truth. It's as far as we're concerned, there's a lot of disinformation that's being piped through that one. But 9/11, do you see what I'm saying? It's a tricky business.
It's easy to
get infiltrated. We are convinced that we've been infiltrated. There's people working within our organizations that many of us are convinced have been working pretty much to undermine us. And
well, they
so
did
it
that
makes
with
a,
the Occupy movement. I mean, they
yeah,
infiltrated
well, that,
the Occupy movement.
That happens. That's I believe that's happened with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and we work hard against it, but it's really hard because it's like, you know, the standard operating procedure is be paranoid. Well, you can only go so far with being paranoid, so you basically end up having to deal with a lot of this kind of thing. And so, anyway, it's a battlefront. The government hasn't given up on trying to cover this up. Hey, I want people like Amy Goodman and Rachel Maddow and some of these voices on the left to take this thing seriously. There is a tremendous amount of very strong, convincing evidence that this was not an, you know, an attack from the outside, but something that was orchestrated from the inside. The left, as well as the right, they will not touch this in the media, even the progressive media. So
I'm really sorry to hear that.
Well,
yeah.
you listen to these people. I mean,
no, I know.
People
I know.
That I otherwise highly respect.
An email
and
campaign.
They won't touch it. Hmm?
Well, yeah, I mean, I know Bill Moore. You know, maybe Bill Moore because he suffered
he won't
so
touch
much.
This.
When he, he's always trying to discredit the truthers. And I think it's because when he spoke out against Bush after 9/11, he lost his show, if you remember. So, you know, he's decided, well, he'll talk about other things, but this is something maybe he's going to keep his mouth shut about, you know.
Well,
so.
I mean, there have to be explanations like that. But if any of you guys are listening, that's what really annoys me is that we can't even get a hearing. Even though what we have to say is, you know, you say it's controversial. It's not controversial. It's blatant. It's absolutely dead cold blatant. This is something where it was done with explosives. We can prove it 9 ways to Sunday, and we can't even get heard about it. So that's very frustrating, but that's sort of the status of things.
Sounds like an email campaign is in order for Amy Goodman and Tom Hartman and Laura Flanders and, mm-hmm. like you said, Rachel Maddow, all the people mm-hmm. on or Current TV, Al Jazeera, you know.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, we have to go, David, but I appreciate what you're doing out there in the world. There's nothing that annoys me more than people being manipulated and being fooled or duped for the purposes of somebody else. I just hate that oppression. I hate that's the way the world is out there. So thank you so much for being on the show. And again, listeners, if you want to see more, because we don't have enough time to go into it anymore, 911speakout.org. So, David, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Okay. And if you have any new developments, let me know and I'll have you back.
Sure.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, next up is Angie Buchanan. She's been here on the show before, and I'm going to let her reintroduce herself to you because she is here and she's asking for our help for the Council for the Parliament of World Religions. Angie, welcome back.
Hi, Karen. Thank you.
So I just found out recently that the Council for the Parliament of World Religions is kind of in a difficult place because of some bankruptcy that arose from poor attendance at a previous parliament. Why don't you sort of just fill listeners in, maybe introduce yourself, tell how you're involved with the parliament, and you know, just sort of bring listeners up to speed, let them know what they can maybe do to help.
I'd love to do that. Thank you so much. So I just wanted to say that my name is Angie Buchanan, and I've been involved in paganism all my life and in the pagan community publicly for about 20 years. I'm a pagan minister, a death midwife, and the director of Earth Traditions, a pagan church in the Chicago area, and I lead Gaia's Womb, an interfaith women's spirituality organization that has been producing weekend retreat for women since 1998. Karen has been a presenter at one of our events, and we loved having you. But today I'd like to talk with your audience about the importance of the interfaith movement to pagans, and particularly about, as you said, the Council for a Parliament of the World Religions and the crisis that this noble organization faces as we speak this evening. Since its birth in Chicago in 1893, which marked the first formal gathering of representatives of Eastern and Western spiritual traditions, and then its rebirth in 1993, the Council for a Parliament of the World's Religions has convened to provide a forum for dialogue among the world's faith traditions. This is an opportunity for people all over the world to come together and to talk about topics that are important to everyone that supersede religion and go into the areas of social justice and planetary care and sustainability. So in 2002, I was the first pagan ever to be elected to the board of this organization to help with the leadership of it, thus opening the door for pagans to have a seat at the international roundtable for the discussion of issues. Some of the issues that are discussed at these events are world peace, environmental and planetary sustainability, clean water, social justice, overcoming religiously motivated violence. Again, things that concern all of us. And since my election, two other pagans have followed as Parliament board members, and that would be Andres Corbin-Arthen of Earth Spirit, who was elected in 2006. Earth Spirit is a pagan organization in Massachusetts. And he was followed by attorney and pagan author Phyllis Cura in 2009. And since that time, our voices and our credibility among the world's religions has increased. The active participation of pagans at every modern parliament, we were present in 1993, in Chicago in 1999, we were present in South Africa, in 2004 in Barcelona, Spain, and in 2009 in Australia, we participated as speakers and ritualists, as panelists and as support staff. And our participation has helped to foster understanding and respect toward pagans all over the world and to challenge misunderstandings and prejudices. So using these opportunities, we were able to join in conversations that corrected misconceptions, healed rifts, and helped to build bridges of understanding among tens of thousands of people. These events are attended by thousands of people.
Yeah, because so we all know the misinformation or disinformation that's out there. So that's really an important task, and especially too when you're building bridges of understanding and common ground. It really goes a long way to religious plurality.
Oh, absolutely, it does, Karen. And the opportunity to speak with people of different spiritual traditions and for them to hear from us who we are and how we move through the world and what are the spiritual things that speak to our hearts, and then to be able to go back to their own communities and say, you know, we have some thinking to do, we have a correction to make, you know, I've met these people and they are as loving and giving and strong as we are, and it just changes a whole perspective of a whole lot of people.
Well, and so, I also wonder, I mean, has Patrick McCollum's success internationally been in large part to people finding out about, who pagans are in the world through the Parliament?
Patrick has been involved with the Parliament as an attendee and on panels and speaking. And, yes, I do believe that he has been able to move through the world the way that he has because of the credibility of being associated with organizations that have a global impact like that.
So, but there's a problem. You guys are having a money problem. So why don't you tell listeners what happened there and what's the consequence if you don't raise whatever the amount of money it is you have targeted on your fundraising goals?
Well, the reason that I'm here tonight is because the Parliament needs our help. And the organization incurred a large and burdensome debt as a consequence of an unexpected drop in the attendance at the 2004 Barcelona Parliament, and that was due to a terrorist attack in Madrid on the train about 4 months prior to the event. So as a result, there was insufficient attendance and therefore insufficient income to cover the expenses of that event. And while we've been paying it off slowly, a Spanish arbitrator ruled against the Parliament, and despite our efforts to challenge the award, a U.S. court has now ruled that the Spanish arbitration award is binding and that the balance of the debt is due immediately.
Was that unusual, Angie? Do you think there was some religious discrimination there? Or?
No, I really don't, Karen. I think that more than anything, it was just a misunderstanding of international law, and there were a lot of other things involved with regard to other organizations that owed some of the money, and they claimed bankruptcy, which left us sort of holding the debt. So, you know, we have this debt now, and in back in the fall, in anticipation that we might lose and be responsible, we started to raise funds then.
Okay.
And we raised about half the amount that was needed. We expected to have several more months to raise the rest, but the remaining balance is now due immediately. So
how much do you need?
Well, we needed to raise $150,000.
Wow.
And,
that's a tough nut to crack.
We had until April 12th to do that.
April 12th, like less than 10 days away.
Exactly. And we've managed to raise about $75,000 of that. So I think that it was originally $276,000 was the debt. And we managed to raise about half of that. And then we've managed to raise about half, again, of the $150,000 that we need. And it's not just the pagan community that's being asked for this. Everyone is being asked to help, you know, in order for us to continue the work of this institution.
So what happens if you can't get an extension or you don't raise the money?
The Parliament's voice will be silenced.
So the whole Parliament shuts down and goes away. It's not just, you know, the pagan earth-based spirituality people are penalized. It's the whole Parliament?
No, it's the whole Parliament.
That's incredible.
It's everything. Yes, it is horrific. So, you know, I'm here to just ask our communities to help to fund the recovery. And I wanted to remind people that in 2009, we came together as a community in an unprecedented way, and we sent five pagans to Parliament to the event in Australia, and we also sponsored a voodoo priest as an interfaith delegate from Africa. So we've done this before, and we can do it again. And we figure, you know, if we ask 3,000 pagans to give $10 apiece, that's $30,000, and you know, we've raised a reasonable percentage of this debt.
There you go. You know, a lot of people giving a little, and it can happen.
Right. That's true. It doesn't matter whether it's $5 or $2,000 or any amount, every amount, whatever helps bring us closer to the goal. But I think it's so important, Karen, that the community jumps in on this, because we're asking you to be a part of the movement that will change the world. We're asking you to help us make history by showing that pagans have numbers and that they're willing to support what they believe in. So it's a matter of stepping up to the plate and saying, okay, we're all grown up now,
mm-hmm.
and we realize.
Put your money where your mouth is, that old saying
exactly.
I used to hear is from my mother. So, Angie, if people want to help you, how do they help you?
There's a website that is out. It's parliamentofreligions.causevox.com/pagans and parliament.
Say that again, please. It was a little garbled.
I'll say it five times. It's parliamentofreligions, www.causevox.com/pagansandparliament. And is spelled out.
Okay. Okay.
And, you know, I know that is just a horrific thing to do, but you can also, you know, to give to somebody, but you can also go to the Parliament of Religions website, and you can find links to it there.
Angie, another thing you could do is go to either my Facebook page or Voices of the Sacred Feminine Facebook page and put the link there as well. I had it on my page a few days ago, but you know how it always drops, you know, it drops down to the bottom. If you can tonight before you go to bed, put it on those pages up near the top. That way listeners will be able to find it more easily, perhaps. You know, maybe that'll help.
All right. I will do that. I'll do it right now. So again, you know, thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak about this. I always come back to the quote by theologian Hans Kung that says, "There will be no peace on earth until there is peace among the world's religions. No peace among the world's religions without dialogue between the religions."
So
and
true.
So this is a thought that allows us to work toward the things that are so important to us as pagans, and the earth and the sacredness of our environment and goddess spirituality and all of those things that mean something to the people of the earth, to the people that follow these earth-based traditions. These are the things that are our spirituality, and when we have an organization like the Parliament that is bringing tens of thousands of people together from all different religions to talk about these kinds of issues, it is essential for us to have a place at that table, and it's essential for us to support that organization so that these conversations and connections can continue. And I just wanted to wrap up by saying that the Parliament events are open to anyone who wants to come. You don't have to be religious clergy or someone that has a reputation within a religious organization. It is for everyone to come and participate in these important discussions that are happening with people who in mass can change the world.
Well, Angie, thank you so much. Thank you for the work you're doing with the Parliament, with Gaia's Womb. You know, you're a woman of incredible integrity, and our community is lucky to have you. And my listeners are very generous, and they're from around the world. So I hope by being on the show tonight, I hope you know, some of them will kick in and help you out, and I will most definitely go there myself tomorrow and make a contribution myself. So thank you, and will you email me and let me know the outcome so that I can let listeners know how this all worked out?
Absolutely, I'd be happy to. And again, Karen, I just am so, so grateful for you to give me this time to speak with you and with everyone that's listening, and to have the opportunity to tell some people some new things and nudge some people about some old things and to get this going.
Well, you know what? It's my pleasure. We all have to help one another. We can't do it alone. We really have to learn to support one another. That's one of the most important things I believe in, reciprocity. So thank you so much, Angie. Good luck with this. And, you know, I think you, it could, based on how much you've raised so far, I think you have a good chance. I think you could maybe make this happen. So good luck.
I think so, too. It's very exciting. And thank you, Karen. Good night.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Well, listeners, our next guest is calling in from the UK, Dominic James, and I do see him there on the switchboard, but I'm going to beg his patience for just a couple little minutes because I'm running just a tad bit behind, and because I owe Jo Carson her commercial.
Most people see humankind is really separate from nature and separate from the earth. I'm as much of this earth as a rock or a tree is. When I came out of it, this is my mother planet. I grew out of this earth.
As long as we can see conceive of divinity as above us or outside of us, or that our bodies are somehow less divine than spirit, there's no way that we can change our course.
Blood of her veins, the rivers, voice of her breath, the wind, fire of her will, erupting volcanoes, green of her hair, the rolling grass hills, strength of her spine, mountains, tall backs, Persephone, moon maiden, whose returning steps grant springtime once more. These are the opening words from Dancing with Gaia. Dancing with Gaia is a wonderful film about the goddess, sacred sexuality, and about connecting to the earth and ways to do that. It gives you tools to connect in a very real way to the landscape and spirit of the earth around you. It's also visually stunning. The DVD comes packaged with a useful booklet, and it's only $20 from dancingwithgaia.com. I've actually seen the DVD, listeners, and I'm really happy to do this promotion for Joe Carson because it is a lovely DVD. So if you're looking for something for yourself, maybe you're feeling in the mood because it's spring, or if you're looking for something different to give a friend, you know, for an upcoming occasion, think about dancingwithgaia.com. So, I am going to unmute my guest from the UK here and tell you a little bit about Dominic before we start our chat. Dominic James is a writer and a Reiki master. He's been a singer-songwriter in various indie bands and has scratched a living as a freelance writer, a barman, a draftsman, and a factory worker. On being made redundant, as he says, in 2008, he committed himself to full-time writing. So he wrote the Reiki Man trilogy, which combines his passion for all things spiritual with his passion for all things temporal. He keeps a foot firmly placed in both worlds, as he says. He wants to bring practices such as Reiki to a wider audience by conveying Eastern ideals in a highly accessible and entertaining content. So that tells you a little bit about Dominic. And Dominic, welcome to the show. Thank you for calling in. I know it's late at night where you are, isn't it?
Yeah, hi, Karen. How are you?
I'm fine. Are you actually calling from the UK or are you in the United States?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
so
I'm in the middle of the night there.
Are you awake?
Yes, I'm just about awake here. It's 20 past 3 in the morning over here. So,
oh,
yeah,
wow.
It's a bit late, but.
Wow. Okay.
But I'm okay.
Okay. Well, good. You sound okay. So Dominic, you've written the Reiki Man trilogy, which I am looking forward to reading for my pleasure. And our topic tonight is Reiki in the world today, or Reiki and fear. And, to me it seems silly that people are afraid of Reiki, but some people are. So why don't we start by saying, okay, if just in case you've never heard of what Reiki is, why don't you sort of, you know, give us the backstory. What is Reiki, and why are some people so afraid of it, if you can speculate?
Well, Reiki, basically translated, means universal life force energy, and it's a healing practice, whereas the practitioner channels the energy from around into the patient and thereby gives them energy to heal themselves, in a nutshell.
Okay. So it's different than chi. Is it? I mean, is it different from chi or you know, what some people call shakti, or is it similar?
Well, they're all energies. They're just different ways of accessing energies. Chi and ki, I'd say, were probably slightly different. Yeah.
Okay. So,
Reiki, I mean, you can draw the energy from anywhere. You can draw the energy from the air, the universe, from the earth, and depending on the practitioner.
And then you sort of redirect it. Redirect it at the point in a person's body that maybe needs the healing.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the practitioner themselves is just a channel, really. The energy goes where it's needed, and you can be intuitive with it and direct it to a certain extent, but ultimately you're just a conduit for the energy.
So you realize this might sound a little a little crazy to some people, you know, because if you can't see it, well, does it really exist? Is there any, you know, in any sort of scientific evidence or anecdotal evidence that Reiki actually works?
Well, I suppose the best evidence is the fact that people all around, that it's growing all around the world, and you know, more and more people every day are using it and going for treatments and learning it. But scientifically wise, I think there have been sort of a few studies done on it. Some are inconclusive. Some have shown that it actually, you know, that it helps patients recover from illness. Sorry, I'm a bit tired.
So
there's been
study done on the
alpha and theta waves.
So that's what you're tapping into, alpha and theta waves?
Yeah.
Okay. And so how, well, for someone who, I mean, I've seen Reiki done, and I've actually tried to do it myself with a small amount of success. I mean, I would draw in the energies around me. I could feel my hands getting hot. And I used it actually to, when my husband was scheduled for surgery, he had to have a knee replacement, so he had a lot of pain in his knees. And I would then sort of take that energy and redirect it to his knee. And you could almost feel that there was something there, you know, between my hand and his skin. And he would tell me that it really did help. Sometimes it would help for days. So was I actually having some success, or were we just fooling ourselves?
Wow. If it felt like it was working, then it was working.
That's what I sort of thought, but, you know, I'm one of these skeptical Virgos. What can I tell you?
Yeah. I think the thing is, if it works for you, it works for you. There's lots of other energy healing methods.
So let me ask you, I've seen stuff on the internet where, you know, the Catholic Church, primarily it always seems like it's the Catholic Church, maybe there are other groups, they seem to be afraid of Reiki. They warn their practitioners not to use it, but they've also warned their practitioners not to do yoga, too. What is that about? I mean, can you speak more specifically about that? I mean, what is it they specifically say to be afraid of? I mean, they're not thinking this is like of the devil or something, are they?
The official line, I think it was the Catholic Church in America that started to get funny about it, and I think the line was that it's not, Reiki is not compatible with Christian teachings.
With no explanation.
That was the official line, but I guess it all stems from, I think, some Catholic retreats were using Reiki as a healing method, you know, on top of the religious stuff, and, you know, for whatever reason, they've decided that it's not compatible with what they're doing. But
interesting. Well, you know, my thoughts on that are, you know, they've always wanted to have an intermediary between human beings and their God, you know, in the name of the priest or in the name of the church. So if someone could tap into some life force, some healing force to heal themselves, in a sense, that's making people too powerful. I think that's another way of making people too powerful. And I don't know, I'm just in the mood tonight to say that, you know, institutions don't want people powerful. They want people manipulated. They want people dependent on them so that they retain power and control. Anyway, that's my soapbox
right,
comment for tonight.
No, I totally agree with you, and I think that's exactly why the Catholic Church has spoken out against it, because they don't want people personally empowered. It doesn't benefit them to have people empowered, does it? Yeah.
No.
It benefits them to have people bowing and genuflecting
and giving them
to
money
and to bishops and cardinals, so that, you know, they can survive as an institution. If people are personally empowered, then they don't have any purpose, do they, in the world?
Right, they become irrelevant. So,
they
Dominic,
irrelevant.
how did you first find Reiki? What drew you to it?
Well, I was working in a factory, and I just split up with my girlfriend, and I was having a few problems. Anyway, I was in there one day, and this guy who I was working with came in, who usually had a load of sort of physical problems. And one day he turned up, and he was all with a spring in his step and leaping all over the place. And I said, "Oh, what's wrong with you? You know, what's happened?" And he said, "Oh, I went to this guy who does this thing called Reiki." And I said, "Okay." So I went, this guy who did the Reiki worked in the factory as well, so I went and had a word with him, and he said, "Oh, come over and we'll have a go on you." So I went over and never looked back, really. It was totally amazing.
So he relieved you of pain, or is that what happened?
I wasn't particularly in pain at the time, but I was having a lot of mental problems and finding it very difficult to concentrate. So, anxiety and depression mainly.
Okay.
And yeah, I went over there and got off the couch, and I just felt better than I had done ever, really.
So how
and it
can
was just
anyone
like the whole
do...
world had opened up for me, exploded in my head.
So Dominic, can anyone be a Reiki practitioner? I mean, is it something we can all learn, or do you have to be maybe more intuitive in order to do the Reiki?
No, anybody can be a Reiki practitioner or have a Reiki treatment. And having Reiki treatments, becoming a Reiki practitioner, makes you more intuitive. It gives you a connection to the energy of the universe, the energy that makes you more intuitive, all those abilities that are latent in the human brain.
So tell me, for listeners who can't visualize this, when you are treating someone, what does it look like? I mean, what do you do? What do they do during this session?
The patient doesn't actually have to do anything. The patient will just lie there and obviously try and get them to relax, but they'll just lie there. And I will, if it's me doing it, I will draw the symbols in my head first and get the flow going with the patient, and then lay my hands on, personally, I'd start off laying my hands on their head or just above. You know, you can touch the aura just above their head and then work from there and just channel the energy and go where your intuition takes you. I mean, that you can use you can be systematic about it and go head downwards, but a lot of people just use intuition and go, place their hands where they feel they ought to be.
Now, I've heard some people say that you can tell where a person may have issues in their body because maybe their body puts off heat in that area. Do you agree with that, or is that not really a universal thing?
Yes, it definitely happens. You get hot and cold spots on patients, definitely. And as you move down, you can feel them with your hands. You can feel different, like say, different heats, different temperatures, but also different energy vibrations. And your hands will, you know, will hit a point and maybe start shaking, and that's always a good sign to stop on there. Or, you know, I may just be drawn to a point magnetically almost, and, you know, that's also a sign that you need to be putting energy there.
So tell
me, like I said before, the energy finds where it needs to go.
So you said something about you visualize the symbols in your head. There are particular Reiki symbols?
Yes, that's right. In the traditional Yusiri Reiki, there are four symbols. There's the master symbol, the power symbol, the mental symbol, and the long-distance symbol, yeah.
And so what do you think that, you know, just like when you have tools and ritual, it really sort of helps your focus. I mean, do you attribute anything to those symbols other than it sort of helps you begin to, or do you think they're magical or powerful symbols, or are they just a tool of focus?
Yeah. They are, they do have power in them, but that it's with the symbols, it's more the intent behind them, I feel, that's the important thing.
So tell me about one or two of your biggest Reiki success stories.
Personal ones? I've not. I don't do a lot of Reiki anymore, to be honest, Carol. As a treatment thing, but most of. The guy who actually taught me and started treating me first, he had quite a few success stories. He's treated people for cancer and a brain tumor.
And he really believes the Reiki contributed to their healing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and look, the guy with the brain tumor, it was more sort of, I've forgotten what the word is now.
So was there a particular reason? Well, I mean, I know you've stopped and to focus on your writing, and we're going to talk about the trilogy in just a minute, but was there any particular reason why you're, I mean, do you still do it for yourself? You just don't do it as a practitioner for pay, or have you sort of just given up on the practice altogether?
No, I haven't given up on the practice altogether. No, I still treat myself, and I still treat people occasionally, but not for pay, because I'm not doing it as a professional. I'm doing it as a something I enjoy doing.
Okay, so you've written the Reiki Man trilogy. Obviously, you know, your Reiki has influenced this. Tell us a little bit about the trilogy.
Well, the trilogy's obviously based around Reiki and the symbols. Well, the first book is, and I was reading when I was first learning about Reiki. I got a book by Diane Steen. It's called Essential Reiki, and in there was a sort of couple of paragraphs about there being a temple in Tibet or India where, you know, another 300 Reiki symbols were housed, and, you know, she said all the speculating on what they did, and I thought to myself, well, that'd be interesting. You know, and my imagination started going wild, and I thought, well, it'd be interesting to find out what these symbols might do and why they were being guarded. And so
that's
the
truth.
Idea
that's,
was born.
That's true. That's not fiction, correct?
Yes. I mean, that's where I got the idea from that. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, obviously, from there, it spawned the idea. And at the time, there was Dan Brown was just coming out with the Da Vinci Code and his books, and I'd been reading them, and I thought that the Reiki angle would fit in nicely to that type of thriller.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sort of page turning type thing. So, I set about writing it.
So have you found out why they guard these symbols?
No, but it would be, you know, I put across a lot of theories in the book and a lot of ideas about why they might.
So what's sort of the synopsis of the trilogy?
Well, the first book is based around the symbols being found and being that they've been put on a box on the lid of a box, and they've come over to England. I won't tell you how, because that's in the book, but it's all about two different factions searching for the symbols. And
and then the second ties in.
Sorry, I was just taking a drink there. My throat's gone a bit dry.
Okay.
Yeah. So you've got the two factions searching for the symbol, searching for this box, and it's based around that. But also, there's a lot of it spiritual information in there as well.
Mhm.
And it's all woven together. That's the first book, the search for these symbols and what happens when they're found. The second book moves on from there and moves more into sort of realms of the church trying to find the symbols. And then the third book moves on again, and that's sort of based around the two major religions of the world vying for power.
Interesting. Sounds provocative. Like it would make fun reading for a vacation.
Yeah, it is fun reading, but I think obviously there's serious points in there as well. But I like to inject humour into the books, and you know, hopefully people just, you know, the main thing I've had is that people just enjoy the books.
Okay. Well, Dominic, is there anything I haven't asked you about the Reiki or the books that you'd like to mention to listeners before we let you get back to sleep?
No. I think we've covered most of the things that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, his website, listeners, if you want to look more into the Reiki Man trilogy, it's his name with his initials. So it's Dominic, DominicCJames.com, DominicCJames.com. So, Dominic, thank you for being such a good sport and getting up in the middle of the night to talk to my listeners about your trilogy and about Reiki. I appreciate it.
That's no problem, Karen. It's a pleasure to do. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
And good luck with your book.
Yeah, and thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Good night.
Good night. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, as we bring tonight's show to a close, I want to remind you of some of our most recent past guests, if you haven't yet had a chance to listen. And please stay with me till the end of the show, because I am going to close with that music that I opened with, We Sound a Call to Freedom, and you'll get to hear all the other verses. But some of the last few guests, in case you've missed them, Tony Burroughs talking about the law of agreement and the power of intention. That was really fun. Earl Lee, psychoactive plants and cults of the dead within ancient and contemporary religion, including Christianity. Amalia Peck of the Goddess Studio, Sacred Space for the Sacred Feminine. Judith Nylan, Ireland's Spiritual Heritage. Constance Tippett, the Goddess Timeline and 30,000 Years of Goddess Imagery. Norm Norman D. Ellis, Ancient Egyptian Magic, Patrick McCullum and Selena Fox. They talked about pagan religious freedom and Lady Libertas. David Hillman, Why Christianity Will Never Defeat Aphrodite. Linda Isles, Bast, the cat goddess of ancient Egypt. I also hope you'll listen to the spring meditation I have there on the Blog Talk archives for you, as well as my talk that I gave at the Goddess Temple called the Magna Mater Palm Sunday. It's about our prophecy for how the world will change when Goddess is restored at the center of the world. And if you're in Southern California area, I will have a booth and be on a panel in the Health Hut for an event out here called World Fest on May 19th in the San Fernando Valley. You can hear me talking about Goddess Ideals for a Sustainable Future, or come by the booth and we can just chat about stuff. Then in June, I'm also going to have a booth at the Long Beach Woman Spirit Fair in Long Beach, California. I hope you'll come by and say hello and maybe buy a few of my books. Next week, our guest are John Michael Greer, and the show topic is spiritual ecology and what mysteries it teaches us and how it's associated with magic. And Charlotte Cressy, an animal rights activist and educator who will also be on that panel with me at WorldFest, is going to be discussing living as love, co-creation of a kind world. Which leads me to closing tonight's show with this Kabbalah wisdom as my final parting words for you tonight, dear listeners. And it goes like this. It says, forgive and forget. Hurt people hurt people. Does that make sense? People who are hurt hurt other people. Abusive patterns get passed on generation after generation, but we can break the chain with our choices. Meet anger with sympathy, meet contempt with compassion, meet cruelty with kindness, meet grimaces with smiles. When you forget about the fault, there is nothing to forgive. Love is the weapon of the future. I think that's my favorite sentence. Love is the weapon of the future. So, as I promised, I'm going to go ahead and play the complete We Sound a Call to Freedom by Jan Aldrich Clanton about how the goddess Sophia is sort of the answer to the world's woes and can help us free ourselves with her wisdom, with her compassion. So I hope you've enjoyed the show tonight, listeners, and please be with me next week. I actually have two shows next week. On Monday, Tom Roberts is going to be on the show with Carolyn Muir. I forgot to mention them, and they're going to be on with me Monday, and Charlotte Cressy and John Michael Greer are going to be on with me on Wednesday. So I have a Monday and a Wednesday show, just to make sure I'm saying that correctly. So next week, I'm with you twice to catch up for when I was sick. So here we go with We Call a Sound to Freedom by Jan Aldrich Clanton. Good night, listeners. Have a great weekend.
We sound a call to freedom that will heal a broken land. As the call rings out more clearly, violent forces will disband. Prison doors will open, bonds will loosen by the Spirit's hand. The truth will set us free. Free at last, oh hallelujah. Free at last, oh hallelujah. Now, Sophia, you have freed us. Your truth has set us free. We are tired of idle promises and token words and deeds. We want equal rights and benefits. Every race and creed, cries of women, men, and children, we want everyone to heed. The truth will set us free. Free. free at last, oh hallelujah. Free at last, oh hallelujah.